Today is November 2nd, 2012. I'd like to take an opportunity to thank everybody for their participation in this Friday evening study. Our study today is entitled Righteousness of the Righteous. As a prelude, I just want to make some brief comments. The Lord has unfolded now a deeper meaning of the peace offering. And as I look in the scriptures, I see a new dimension that yields for protection and safety beyond which we have not considered before. Do you know from scripture that you can offer a sacrifice to benefit your loved ones? Think back to Job. Job was described as being one of the wealthiest men in all the land. But the Lord didn't give you a bottom line dollar figure for his bank account. What the Lord did to exemplify his wealth was to list for you the number of animals that he had. His sheep, and his cattle, and his camels, and his goats. You go back in Job chapter 1, be sure that you read up on this, because I'm just going to touch it in passing. But Job was worried that his children, his seven sons and two daughters, may have cursed the Lord. And Job was described, you know, as the most righteous man on the planet, and that was validated by the devil's cross-examination. And what did Job do? Job offered a sacrifice just to preclude his children from hazard. I find that remarkable, because in the midst of this, Job was pronounced righteous. And this gives us a window of understanding when David says the Lord is going to affirm our righteousness, not just his own. You know what I'm referring to in Psalms chapter 37. We might be able to get to it as we advance in the study. But the Lord said that he was going to bless, if we're faithful, we trust in him, he's going to bless our righteousness. I'm so glad that I see evidence now of brethren of the mustard seed sending, although I know their children are wayward, sending tithe and offering to cover them. Yesterday your wealth wasn't measured by monetary treasures, by silver and gold, but cattle and sheep. If you didn't have those things, you could not exist. Therefore, if you took of those and gave it to the Lord, you were exemplifying the same degree of the sacrifice that you do when you open up your checkbook today. And that's what you were doing. And don't let it confuse you when it says burnt offering. Because if you study the peace offering, the burnt offering is a component of sacrifice that's not only contained in the atonement, but it's integral to the peace offering as well. That's why we look to Noah. When he left the ark, it didn't indicate that his sons and his daughters had any appreciation for the experience. But Noah, being the master of the planet, took one of every clean beast, the Bible tells me, and offered them for sacrifice. And that gave peaceful passage for him and for his children. That was their peace offering. Although the Bible refers to it as a burnt offering. I didn't intend on spending too much time on this, but one more example comes to view. Abraham was commissioned to offer his son for sacrifice. Now, it's remarkable because Isaac said, he said, we have the wood. Where is the sacrifice? Abraham said, the Lord will provide a sacrifice. Please capture that and bring that into your hearts for meeting. Because it shows you that a peace offering does not have to come from the people who need it. Oftentimes, the Lord will give you the peace offering. Therefore, when Abraham saw that ram caught in the thicket, he offered that as a sacrifice. And that was a manifestation of his peace. His gratitude that the Lord preserved his son. This is something that we need to understand. The planet is going to be preserved by peace offering, as well as by atonement. Now, having said that, let us see if we can advance into our study and maybe pick up on a little of that as we close. I'd like to take you to Deuteronomy chapter 6. We're going to begin by reading verse 20. We're going to go from verse 20 through 25. And when thy son asketh thee in time to come, saying, what mean the testimony and the statutes and the judgments which the Lord our God hath commanded you? Then thou shalt say unto thy son, we were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders great and sore upon Egypt, upon Pharaoh, and upon all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from thence, that he might bring us in to give us the land which he sware unto our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive, as it is at this day. And it shall be our righteousness, if we observe to do all these commandments before the Lord our God, as he hath commanded us. This text is replete with New Light themes. Hopefully we can accentuate all of them. But the first thing that you should notice is the lesson comes from the inquiring son, the child. The Lord expected his church to convey the meaning of his laws and his statutes to people of lesser light and knowledge. And he says, this is our righteousness. He could not have just meant simply that one generation. For this was a commission and a commandment. That means 300 generations from now, 400, however long, you had a duty and a responsibility to remind those for whom your responsibility is to educate. Let's take that term son to be proverbial. You had a duty and responsibility to show them your righteousness. Some people don't like the concept of righteousness by works, but this is your work. It's integral with your faith. The reason why you embrace the Lord's testimonies, his statutes, and his judgments, and his commandments was because he freed Israel from Egyptian bondage. So next time somebody inquires of you, you'll know how to begin your retort and your study. And evidently, it's for your own good. Therefore, people who do not follow this path continue to suffer under bondage. The Lord expands that theme of bondage in John chapter 8. He says, he that committeth sin is a servant of sin. He came to free us. That's why he referred to the disciples indeed. He said, if you continue in my word, then are ye my disciples in truth. Is that what he said? Then are ye my disciples in light. Is that what he said? He said, ye are my disciples indeed. That's another word to say, my disciples by work. That's the grace that you receive by continuing in his word. Then are ye my disciples indeed. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. When you receive your freedom, go out and tell those who are inquiring about why it is that you observe the Lord's commandments. And give them this light and this grace pertaining to your freedom. See, our righteousness is yielded only by this educational process. Some folks don't like new light. They don't like, they resist education. But the Lord offers this remedy for those who look for education, the inquiring mind. Those who are inquisitive. What's another word for that that we need to remember? Another word for that is what? Those who are considerate. See, when you're considerate, you ponder things. Why the Lord's love? That's a good question, the Lord said. Don't slap the child down. How dare you question God? See, that's the light I was brought up under in a less enlightened age. You know, the question that the inquiring mind wants to know is, why the Lord? Why not the Masons? Why not the heathens? See, none of those people have freed you from bondage. But the Lord has. He expects you to understand the benefits. This is not a one-way deal. You receive benefits, and you need to respond by praising the Lord, by your peace offering. Verse 24, and let me reiterate it. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always. Now you see there's a clue that you could not comply with this yesterday. Moses and all the generations following could not comply. This was a mission for the disciples indeed. They're the only ones that can discern good. Somebody thought yesterday that it was a good thing to build their house on Long Island. And as wise and as wealthy as they were, Hurricane Sandy proved they built their house upon the sand. It wasn't for their own good. Don't tell me it's impossible to obey the law. Don't tell me that righteousness through works is vain. Because it's only vain if you don't know what's good for you. Done for our good. Only pertinent to a people who have left the principles of the doctrine of Christ and moved on unto perfection. That's what Paul tells you. He didn't qualify himself as such a person, but he said, for everyone that uses milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongeth unto them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on unto perfection. The people who can comply with this, the disciples indeed, are those, according to Paul and according to other texts, who have advanced in Christology. They've left behind the milk doctrine and have embraced into themselves a new and higher doctrine of Christ, a strong meat doctrine. Thus they're able to discern the difference between good and evil. Therefore, obedience wins for us life. Let's look at that now. And we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 30. Verse 19 and 20. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him. For he is thy life, and the length of thy days, that thou mayest dwell in the land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. Again, this could only pertain to the people this day. The only way you could keep the Lord's statutes and laws and win the life is if you're alive. And the benefit of that is that it allows you and your seed to live. Well, how does it that your seed begins to live? Shouldn't your seed also be complying with this? Well, there are other ways to bring your seed in, and one is by the peace offering. But let it be understood that this is a promise, not just for temporal life, but for everlasting life. What good does it do if you live to 200 years old, but then you have to die? Then your obedience in the law has been vain. Because the only validation given to you for compliance to the law is that you'll live. Not that you'll pass on a legacy that lives, which happened yesterday, but that you and your seed shall live. Therefore, as we advance, we need to remember, consideration by the youthful query yields our righteousness, which gives to us life everlasting. You're familiar with Deuteronomy 18. It speaks to this. The Lord thy God shall raise up in thee a prophet from among thy brethren, like unto me. Unto him shall ye hearken, according to all that thy soul desires in Horeb in the day of assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, neither let me see this great fire, that I die not. And the Lord said, they have well spoken that which they have spoken. The Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee, of thy brethren, like unto me. Unto him shall ye hearken, according to all that thou desirest of the Lord thy God, in Horeb, in the day of assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, neither let me see this great fire anymore, that I die not. The church pleaded to the Lord that they wouldn't die. It has its greatest meaning that they would have life perpetuated. And the Lord said unto me, they have well spoken that which they have spoken. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. The Lord was going to raise up a prophet. We know that that prophet was Jesus. And the way that we receive the Lord's commendation is that we hearken unto his words. Thus, when the less experienced among you ponder why you obey the Lord's commandments and his testimonies, inculcated in that is the communications that the Lord would deliver to the saints through Jesus. The church didn't want the Lord to speak directly to them. He covenanted that he would not. He could have said, I'm finished talking to you, but no, he knew that he had more to say. Pointing to Jesus, he said, I will speak through Jesus. I will raise up a prophet, and he shall speak unto you all that I shall command. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. Sadly, though, we look back through the Old Testament experience, and we see that the brethren who complied in righteousness still died. Therefore, though those for whom we teach may not ask, we should be asking, why is it that the righteous passed? And as we're going to see in our study, there are two levels of righteousness. That's what Ezekiel 33 shows us. You know, you're familiar with Ezekiel 33. The Lord sends Ezekiel, refers to him as the what? The Son of Man. He says, I have appointed you as a watchman to speak unto this people. Then he says, when I say to the righteous that they shall surely live. Well, this is what we are looking for, life. And if they do not comply, then all their righteousness will be made of no avail. Therefore, those who comply are the righteous righteous. And that's what we're talking about. Righteousness of the righteous. Just like their multi-tiers to discipleship. Remember, we showed that the disciples indeed, the sons and daughters of God, ascend to the upper room. Whereas the lower tier disciples that came in under the 120 ascended after Calvary. But they were not given the same status. There are multi-tiers of righteousness. Just because you're righteous doesn't mean that you've escaped the grave. How is it, therefore, that you can escape the grave? Well, when we talk about escaping the grave, we talk about that victory, we need to turn to John 3:16 and get deeper insight. It says, verse 16, "For God so loved the world." Oh, Brother Wesley, you don't have to continue. I'm familiar with this. Every Christian and even non-Christian are familiar with this. So there's no need to read. Now, don't waste our time. Advance to the next point. But I respectfully disagree. You may have heard this before, but you never understood it. "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life." That answers your question, because the only way that you could have everlasting life is if the Lord gives you life that lasts forever. That's not the same as eternal life. Now, if you have everlasting life, you have eternal life. Those who win it from their birth have won everlasting life. But if you go through the grave, you don't have life that lasts forever. You have life that's interrupted by death. And then is succeeded by life again. Those who receive everlasting life, as Deuteronomy 18 showed us, are those who believe the words uttered by the prophet that Christ promised to raise up unto them. "I will raise up unto them a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee, Moses, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak all that I shall command of him. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him." It's the Lord speaking, pertaining to the prophet he was going to raise up, who's Jesus. Therefore, we have referred to him as Jesus Christ. In the 2,000 years of his ministry, perishment has not stopped. Righteous people continue to pass into the grave. But today we're talking about the righteousness of the righteous. They are the ones that heed the commission of John 3:16. They believe in the only begotten of the Father. Jesus was begotten of the Father. He's the vehicle through whom Christ relayed his testimony. And if you cannot discern the difference between Jesus and Christ, then you can't believe in the only begotten. And if you've ignored the utterances that he proclaimed, then you likewise can't believe on him. This is why you went into the grave. Let me revisit now Deuteronomy 18 to further elucidate this point. It says the prophet, not the false prophet. This is verse 20. It says the prophet. E.G. White was a prophet, wasn't it? V.T. Hotev was a prophet. Paul, Peter, James, John, they all fit this definition, the prophet. Why did they die? Was it because they were not righteous? Of course they were righteous. The Lord used them as his vehicle to convey light. But they didn't have the righteousness of the righteous. "But the prophet which shall presume to speak a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or that shall speak in the name of other gods, even that prophet shall die." Paul and all those other stellar prophets thought that they were speaking in the name of Christ, when in essence they were speaking in the name of another god. Not a false god, but just another god that did not come under the name of Christ. That doesn't mean that we're polytheists. We only believe that God the Father, just as Jesus pronounced to us, is right. But he designated a ministry to lead us back to him by use of Jesus through the past 2,000 years. He reached out to the Gentile world. That's why it says, "For God so loved the world." See, I told you, you didn't understand what that meant. But the day is going to come when the Gentile ministry is going to close. all those people who confuse Jesus with Christ. And they'll tell you, Jesus is God. No, he's not. If you think he is, then you don't believe on him. They'll tell you that Jesus created the world. No, he did not. If you do not believe that, then you don't believe on him. You're confusing Jesus with God and with Christ. Christ was the dove that clandestinely rested in a boat and spoke through him. And your life everlasting without perishment hinges upon you believing that. Well, suppose that the Lord didn't understand the word perish. Because you know, he didn't say, ye shall not die. He said, ye shall not perish. There are some folks that think that when you go to the grave, that your spirit lives on. But that can't be a reference to what the Lord is talking about, because the person who's you is told is going to perish unless you believe in the only begotten of the Father. Whether it be your spirit or your body, whatever you define as being you, that being is supposed to perish unless you meet that criteria. I like what he says in Luke chapter 11. Let's read verse 46. Woe unto you also, ye lawyers. He's not talking about the people that we refer to as lawyers, attorneys at law. He's talking about people that were practitioners of the Mosaic law. Those were the lawyers, experts in the law. A woe was pronounced. Well, what's wrong, Lord, with being an expert in Moses' law? Well, he tells you, there's a woe pronounced on you. Why? For ye laid men with burdens grievous to be borne. This is why folks are talking about it's impossible to obey the law. Because lawyers have perverted the law. They have increased the burden. We've talked a lot about that. And you yourselves touch not the birds with one of your fingers. That's why they're hypocrites. I like, with just diverging from Luke 11 for a second, returning back to it quickly, I like what 1 John 5 verses 1 through 3 says. It says, whosoever believeth that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. That's very important. Because you have to believe that Jesus is the Christ, not that Jesus is Christ. Jesus being the Christ means that Jesus is the prophet through whom Christ designated that he would speak. That means he's the light of Christ. If you believe that, then you're born of God. If you don't believe it, then you're not born of God. What does it mean to be born of God? We're expanding this theme, and it has multi-dimensions, some of which we can't touch on right now. Whosoever believeth that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone that loveth him that begot, loveth him also that is begotten of him. By this we know that we love the children of God. When we love God. I didn't know that God had children. I know we talked about that in times past, but when he refers to children, he's referring to the definition of Matthew chapter 12, where Christ pointed to the disciples and said, those who do the will of my Father, the same are my brother, my sister, and my mother. Those were the children of God. Those are the people that fit in the family of God. Continuing, by this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep his commandments. This is not talking about Christ's commandments. It's talking about God's commandments. Those utterances that he commissioned Christ to convey to the church through Jesus. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not grievous. It's impossible to obey the law. Hush up now. His commandments are not grievous. And this is what we learn as we revert back to Luke chapter 11. We read verse 46. Now we're going to read verse 51 and 52. For the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zacharias. Why do we need to talk about Abel and Zacharias? You ever wonder about that? Perhaps you're wondering now. Let's read on and maybe we'll get an answer. which perisheth between the altar and the temple. Verily I say unto you, it shall be required of this generation. These two men perished. How is it that they perished? Hold your hands there in Luke chapter 11. And let's go to read a comparable text in Matthew chapter 23. Matthew gives the same utterance here, but gives us a little bit more insight. Verse 35. Upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias. And reverting back to Luke 11, we see that Abel and Zacharias were deemed by Father to be righteous. Yet, that could not win for them life, because they didn't have the righteousness of the righteous. Luke 11, verse 51 again, for the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, which perisheth. These people, though righteous, they perished. If the Lord placed your name in that text, that means that you too potentially could perish. Because he deemed these two individuals as righteous. Would the Father give the same evaluation for you? That's why John 3:16 says, if you believe on the only begotten of the Father, ye shall not perish. Your fate is going to be different than the fate of righteous men who passed before you. Luke 11, verse 52. Woe unto you lawyers, for ye have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye enter not into yourself, and them that were entering ye hinder. He starts out giving a denunciation, a woe to the lawyers, the experts of the law, but those who made the law so grievous that people could not comply. And the reason why they could not comply, now we see, because they had taken away the key of knowledge. What's the key of knowledge? Because if you understand the key of knowledge, then nobody can take it away from you. The key of knowledge is the ability to discern between good and evil. When you have that key, not only can you educate the unsophisticated, showing them the reason why they need to comply with the law, but you can receive life everlasting. You could receive life without perishment. The life that is extended and promised to Israel that will be preserved unto them when they teach a very commission of the law, the youthful and curious, those that consider the law and seek them for understanding. In case you may not know, not all children are inquisitive. Some will just do their own thing. But the ones that inquire, you have to teach. And by teaching them, you preserve your life. It's your righteousness. You are going to be credited righteousness for your teaching skills. And that's how Israel is going to be preserved in the land. In fact, we now know that the curse of Adam precluded, whether you be righteous or wicked, precluded an escape from the grave. This is why Abel, who was deemed righteous, died. He did not have life. And Cain died. Cain was evil. Abel was righteous. But when you receive the key of knowledge, you unlock to yourself salvation. Oh, if we had time, we could go to Revelation chapter 9 and show that the star that came down from heaven, referring to Christ, had the key to the bottomless pit. And when he unlocked that key after the major sacrifice was made, it says locusts emerged out of the pit. I wish I had time to expand upon that. But that key will be delivered to you. It's the key of knowledge. It exemplifies the Christian experience that occurred after Calvary. People who emerged out of the pit escaped the earth's gravitational tug, which the bottomless pit is. And all bottomless pit is a pit that has no bottom. It's an eternal fall. It's a black hole. That's what Christ did for the world. He spread forth the heavens and said, "Let there be light." He allowed for light to emerge from earth's origin, where he says, "Darkness covered the face of the great deep." But we're getting a little bit aside ourselves here and venturing forward into a topic that we can explore at a later date. Suffice it to say that the Father said, because man partook of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Some people say, wasn't that a good thing? It's only a good thing if you have the key. If you don't have the key, then you suffer. That's why Father said, "Behold, man has become one of us to know good and evil." And when you know that, you embrace the testimony of Jesus, you become a disciple indeed. By your works, you become a disciple. By continuing in His Word. It should be stated that to continue in His Word means that yesterday you had the testimony of Jesus, but you did not fully understand it. Ergo, our understanding of John 3:16. But today, you revisit the same testimony. It's not a new testimony. It's the same testimony with deeper, expanded meaning. And that deeper, expanded meaning is what gives to you life everlasting. That's righteousness added to the righteous. That's what preserves your life. Now we can revisit some other texts that we're well familiar with as we try to embrace the light that emanates therefrom. We don't need to be worried that it's going to destroy us, as ancient Israel feared from Christ as He spoke to them directly from Sinai. "Whoa, that's too much light. I'm going to die." This is light shielded by the Christ, the prophet likened to Moses, the one through whom Christ promised to illuminate His Word. Therefore He said, John 6:25, "And when they had found Him on the other side of the sea, they said unto Him, Rabbi, whence camest thou?" I didn't even know Christ. I didn't even know Jesus. That you left. Where did you come from? You were on one side of the sea, and now you're on the other. There are folks that are seeking after the Lord that will make a transition and that will cross the sea. What their experience were yesterday on the other side is not going to be the same graces if they heed the Lord's commission that they will receive on the side where they find the Lord. If you continue to linger on the other side, you're no longer going to find Christ. He was there yesterday, but you have to follow the Lamb whithersoever He goeth. And as you follow, you have to heed His commission. He says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me, not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat of the loaves and were filled." When they were on the other side, the Lord fed them differently. He said, that was good yesterday, but you need to now change your diet if you're seeking me. Yesterday you were filled. You did righteous yesterday. Now you need the righteousness of the righteous. You need to become a disciple indeed. You need to continue in my word. It's going to require some work. Well, I don't mind. I mean, I work to pay the mortgage. I work to pay my car note. I work to keep my utilities on. Why can't I work to live? Well, you got to work. He says, labor not for the meat which perisheth. Did you get it? The meat on the other side was efficacious only for that day. And this is those This is what's reflected in those who fall under the metaphor of Hurricane Sandy. That meat has perished. That gig is up. It was good yesterday and it filled you. But it says don't labor for that. That was the day when you did not, by Paul's commission, seek salvation by works. Today you must seek salvation. You must labor for the meat which doesn't perish. Labor not for the meat which perishes, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life. One phase of Jesus' testimony did not lead to everlasting life. And this is what we manifested. Those who heeded it were righteous, but like Abel, they had to pass into the grave. Labor for the meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. He could have said, for him have I sealed. Don't you realize that the Father is the one that's orchestrating this work? He's got agents. He couldn't come down on Sinai himself. If they felt they would die by Christ's presence, then surely they would have been obliterated by the Father's. He needed a Secretary of State, somebody that had power of attorney to represent him. And therefore, Christ says, I did not seal this servant. God, the Father, sealed him. He's the one that can give you everlasting life. Labor for the meat which endureth forever. Which the Son of Man, we spoke of Ezekiel. He told Ezekiel, Son of Man, I have sent you as a spokesman for me. This is in reference to that same prophecy. He says, labor for the meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. You want to be a disciple indeed, this is your work. You have to labor for that meat. But it's not a grievous labor. And that's what we read in John earlier. This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not grievous. That means you have to cut through all the red tape that has been imposed upon you by the lawyers. The professed, skilled purveyors of the law. Only thing is, if you're going to labor, that is only going to be unfolded to you in the last day. Consider, as you understand that, consider, that's an important word, isn't it? The illustration that we receive here in this very text. The saints embraced the Lord's meat, but the Lord rebuked them for that. It was good when they were on the other side. It was good that they traveled to meet up with the Lord. But now he says that that meat is no longer efficacious. Christianity was to go through a 2,000-year period whereby no matter what they did, they would not receive life everlasting. Because the Son of Man needed to be raised up to distribute that meat. This is why we don't call the prophets of yesterday false. Those whom we could validate that had the meat served up on the other side. And Jesus answered and said unto them, this is the work of God. This labor assignment. Oh, I don't believe in righteousness by works. Then you don't want to receive the righteousness of the righteous. Those who are going to receive everlasting life. Because Christ says you should labor for that meat. He says, this is the work of God, that ye believe on him whom he hath sent. Now, he sent Christ to rest upon Jesus to enlighten us with this gospel. But then he promised that he spoke only proverbially then. But in the last day he was going to revisit it and speak to it plainly. And that's why he says in verse 39, and this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. Raise what up again? This vehicle that's going to win for you everlasting life. Because he tells you in John 8:51, check this out as you review this study, he says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, if a man keep my sayings, he shall never see death." Evidently, those sayings are only available now with the Son of Man, whom Father recommended to you. He says, "I will raise up again at the last day." Consequently, his rebuke towards those who traversed the sea and sought after Christ was only metaphoric and proverbial to be applicable to us today, because they could not labor for the meat that was served up by the one whom the Father has sealed, because he said, "I will raise him up at the last day. I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son," talking about the sealed Son, the Son of Man, Ezekiel, the one who speaks for him. You know, in John chapter 13, it says, "Whosoever receiveth him that I send, receiveth me. And he that receiveth me, receiveth him that sent me." Therefore, by your reception of the one whom the Lord has sent, that wins for your everlasting life. See, even as a mustard seed Davidian, in good standing, you can't proclaim that you will not die unless you heed the wisdom that's purveyed to you by the one through whom Christ has sent. And that's the burden of this study. You want the righteousness of the righteous today. You don't want the righteousness of Abel. "And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life." What's everlasting life? Life that lasts forever. Life without perishment. "And I will raise him up at the last day." Oh, that's a blessed promise. One that we can celebrate. This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. Therefore, we can use Abel as an icon of the righteous that die. Don't confuse this work that we're talking about with the work that commends those described in Matthew chapter 25 and written in other texts of the mustard seed. You know, he says, "I was a hungered and you fed me. I was in prison and you visited me." That salvation by works represents a people who come and likewise see the King, the Son of Man. And they are given salvation because of the good works that they did during the time before the Son of Man was raised up. And by embracing his call to the kingdom, "Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world," they begin to comply with hearing, seeing, and believing the one whom Christ has sent. We're talking about the disciples indeed. We're talking about those that will begin this initiation of righteousness by works, which is different than the concept conveyed in Matthew chapter 25. I hope that you can understand that distinction. I insert that because I anticipated that question. We have two classes amongst us this day, and everybody has an opportunity to make their calling and election sure. That calls my attention to John chapter 11. Let's read verse 24 through 26. "Martha said unto him," in reference to Lazarus' death, "I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Martha got some wisdom by her connection to the Lord. She knew that there's going to be a resurrection at the last day. In fact, there is going to be a resurrection of people that sleep in the earth in the last day that are going to be commensurate with the Lord's raising up of the Son of Man in the last day to convey in plainness his gospel. "And Jesus said unto her," now when Jesus spoke, this is Christ speaking. That's why we inserted Deuteronomy 18. "I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak all that I shall command him." This is our righteousness. Is Christ our righteousness? Thus, when Jesus said this, this is Christ speaking. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. We see Christ's power in duality now. He's got the power to resurrect, and he's got the power to keep you from perishing. That's why he says, I'm just not the resurrection, I'm just not the life. I am both of those. I have two qualifications that you need for this study, Martha. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, he that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. That's a new dimension to the righteousness of the righteous. Because there are mustard seed Adventists that have gone to the grave. And they've gone understanding the distinction between Jesus and Christ. He that believeth in me, though he be dead, yet shall he live. In other words, these are saints that did not heed the counsel of John 8:51 and John 6, what was it, 39 and 40, I believe. John 8:51, again, I remind you, verily, verily, I say unto you, if a man keep my sayings, he shall not see death. Therefore, if you keep his sayings, ye shall not see death. But if you understand the difference between Christ and Jesus and don't keep his sayings, then you don't have a guarantee to be shielded from death. If you don't comply with the counsel afforded to you by the one whom he has sent, the Son of Man, the atypical Ezekiel, then though you believe on him, even though you're dead, yet shall you live. Get a second opportunity to embrace this work. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Therefore, if you want the life that lasts forever, you have to heed the counsel that the Lord gave to you, which extends beyond learning the difference between Christ and Jesus. That's why John 3:16 says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believe in him shall have everlasting life. To believe on him in that context means you have to receive the message that he delivered. That's why in chapter 12, we're told in verse 47 through 50, if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. Believe in Christ, and I'm going to judge you. He's got his antitypical Moses, the Son of Man, to judge you. For he says, he that rejecteth me receiveth not my words. Did you get that? If you don't receive his words, if you don't receive the testimony, he says, he that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The words that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. That's why he told the disciples. He told them about the prime minister in Matthew chapter 20. And he said that you must fall under his commission and his administration. Let's take a moment and read that. Matthew chapter 20, verse 25 through 28. I don't want to believe what the Son of Man teaches. I don't want to believe what antitypical Ezekiel teaches. Who does he think he is? Doesn't matter who he thinks he is. It's whom the Lord designated him to be. It says, ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them. And they that are great exercise great authority upon them. The disciples are fearful of a tyrant reigning over them because their only experience in judgment was people whom they've known before that continuously oppressed them. But it shall not be so among you. The disciples, not going to be that way. You come around me, maybe you can only do 20 push-ups. I don't make you do 30. or 40. I'm not exercising great authority upon you. It shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. That means you have to allow him to tell you how to receive life. He's the quintessential teacher whom the sons inquire to. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. We've seen that already through John 13, the one who washes your feet. Even as the Son of Man came, not to be ministered unto, but to minister. How should we let him be our minister? The same way you let the Son of Man be your minister. Because Christ sent him. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. This points to a day where there's going to be a union of faith and works. It requires great faith to give credence to this servant, because he opens up to you the testimony of Jesus and shows to you scriptures you thought you knew, but you never really understood it. But let the message ring true. Those who keep Father's commandments will never die. They are the sons and daughters of God. That's the righteousness of the righteous. That reminds me of David's refrain in Psalms 37. We're not going to take the time to read it all. I just want to point to you some very special messages here. Verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. As you read that, now think back to how we began the study from Deuteronomy 6 with the inquiring minds. This was the promise that would be conveyed to them, that they would dwell, that by heeding the counsel, the commands, the judgments of the Lord, that it would be their life. And this is what David promises. And David's promises pertain to the Lord, were affirmed to us by Jesus' testimony that he would fulfill them all. Verily thou shalt be fed. What is the feeding they're going to receive? It's that feeding that those servants who traipsed the sea from the 5 loaves and 2 fishes that they were fed on the one side, who sought the Lord on the other side, and the Lord commissioned them to labor for the meat that perisheth not, which the Son of Man was to give unto them. Trust in the Lord and do good. You have to know the difference between good and evil to do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Let's go to verse 34. Wait on the Lord, keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. I like that. Underscore that in your minds, because you're going to have a tie back to it as we advance in the study. If you wait on the Lord, I can't understand what's taking so long. Be patient. Wait on the Lord. Keep his way. What's his way? His way is unfolded to you in the testimony of Jesus. And he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. Already we see now, with Hurricane Sandy, hit the American northeastern coast in the last week of October 2012, then we can see that this prophecy, when the wicked are cut off, has already begun. David says in Psalms 37, I have seen the wicked in great power, and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. How in the world could power be reduced so quickly? So David saw it, and this is going to happen. Then he says, for your preservation, he says in verse 37, mark the perfect man. Well, that could only be the one who delivers you everlasting life, because nobody else's perfection could benefit you, especially if you're going to go into the grave. Mark the perfect man. Why should you mark him? The Father's marked him. He sealed him. The mark and the seal, something we've learned to be the same. Mark the perfect man, and behold the upright. For the end of that man is peace. I like that. His end is peace. We spoke a little bit about the peace offering. He's the one that gives the peace offering. That's why you mark him. Abraham delivered peace to Isaac. He preserved him by the sacrifice. It wasn't even Abraham's ram. The Lord provided for him a sacrifice. If you latch on to the perfect man, he will have the vehicle to win for you peace. The one who is ordained to offer sacrifice. And Jacob's sons committed brutality and murder. They were looking for peace. Therefore, they went up to Bethel and offered a sacrifice. Noah's sons trapped in the ark with their wives, seeking peace. And Noah offered a burnt offering. Today, we're going to have the marked man. And the end of that man is our peace. You know, speaking of peace, we need to delve into that just a little bit now. We're in a presidential election, and it's remarkable with American-style politicians that when it's time for re-election, what do? They recite to you all the good things that they have done. Why do they need to recite it? Because people forget. God is not an American-style politician. He expects you to remember. He expects you to tell him the good he has done for you. And it's not just lip service. See, you want to really express your peace offering, take one of your vast collection that he's blessed you with and offer it to the Lord. I don't have any sheep or goats. Okay? Well, you use your imagination and see what you can encounter to bring peace to your household. Mark the perfect man, the end of that man is peace. Salvation doesn't work if you continuously forget. And this is the experience we've had in the early Christian dispensation. All the bountiful blessings that Jesus has bestowed upon the church, and nobody gives him credit. Be nice if he had a politician to show you the benefits that he has bestowed upon you, right? That's the man of peace. That's the peace offering. You can't remember, but if he can, then he can offer that sacrifice for you. But let it be known that the Lord doesn't extend graces upon you if you're going to be forgetful. We see this amongst us now. People locked in prison and they're praying and yearning for freedom. People needing employment and they're agonizing to the Lord to give them employment. People learning, yearning, and burning for benefits that they feel could help them in their lives. Why, Lord, don't you hear my prayers? Because you're forgetful. Because when you receive it, you're just going to forget the fact that I gave it to you. And you're going to revert back to your old ways. Why should the Lord free you from prison if you're going to tomorrow forget how much you yearn for it and go back to your old ways? Better that you just stay there until you learn righteousness. Or mark the perfect man. The end of that man is peace. Wait on the Lord, reiterating verse 34, and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. Verse 39. But the salvation of the righteous. Now what righteous are these? This is the disciples indeed. This is the righteousness of the righteous. But the salvation, what's salvation? That means they're vindicated. That means they're rescued from a dastardly result. They're saved. They don't have to pass through the grave. That's why it says the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. We mean of the Lord. Talk about Jesus? No, we're talking about Christ. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. But he says, but the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble. Oh, what are we going to do? hurricane is projected to come. I told you, you can't trust scientists. You can't rely upon them. You trust the Lord. And if He told you not to build your house upon the sand, and you followed and heeded His instruction and built it upon the rock, that rock is Christ, then that's your salvation. He'll preserve you. But you have to intensify in your consideration. You have to be like that inquiring son who asks. When you ask, that means your mind is ripe for learning. That's the process that the Lord engendered to teach. Some people say, let me gather my children around and teach them. No, practice the principles of righteousness, and when your children see it, they're going to come and ask you. Then that's how they learn the best. I'm just learning right now how to be a good parent. And this is a benefit and a blessing that the Lord is growing us in His grace. That's why I like to read Isaiah 57. Just picking up on verse 13, he speaks of what David referred to. Talking about the day when Assyria is going to meet her judgment. I'm talking about the day when she is going to begin to experience her problems. It says, when thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee. Some folks got this great faith in businessmen. You see, let them deliver you. I've got these great skills to create jobs. I have this ability to make money. Okay, you want to trust in them? When you begin to find out you're in trouble, let those businessmen deliver you. When thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee. But the wind shall carry them all away. Vanity shall take them. Talking about the perfect man. But he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. He's going to be a shelter in the time of storm. Oh, you need to go back and study the entire chapter. Let me just reflect back to verses 1 and 2. The Lord says, the righteous perisheth. Who does that remind you of now? Abel. The Lord called him righteous, didn't he? The righteous perish? No man lay it to heart. You know what? Why haven't you asked? Like the inquisitive son. Isn't a good question, isn't it? Why do the good die young? Why is it that the righteous perish? If they serve God, why don't they live forever? Somebody needs to inquire so they can learn. The righteous perish, and no man lay it to heart. The merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. I prepared a poem, and let me cite it to you right now. Let us heed the plea for wisdom relayed to us from heaven. Let us hear the man Isaiah. And read verse 1 of 57. The righteous perish, none lay it to heart. The Bible doth proclaim. Merciful men are taken away, and none bother to explain. Christianity sweeps this land of ours. Its success none can deny. Yet one question looms unanswered. Why must the righteous die? The scholar and the erudite seal the church in their credo. While secured in their vanity, elucidation they cannot show. With all the teachings brought to us, this query they do belie. How come none ever postulate or explain the reason why? To cure us in this blindness, the Lord mixed dirt with holy spit. To place the salve upon our eyes, to make the church considerate. Why did Abel pass in death? Did not he embrace God's law? His fatal lapse into the tomb sparked a faith in Christ withdrawal. No voice for him to bless the Lord, no chords to sing his praise, no steadfast hand to herd the sheep, no love to seek the strays, no smile to joy the heart of Eve, no son for her to cherish. Why does Abel stand no more? Why did he have to perish? His thoughts, his charm, his feelings, all wasted now with death. His call to lead in righteousness has expired as did his breath. Which son could Adam teach of Christ? His heart yearned for another. He could never bless the evil son, the one who killed his brother. Christ called Abel righteous. What meaneth to us this claim? What grace is there in his great word if death we must sustain? The preacher and the prophet proclaim their gospel in the land. But if this question they cannot resolve, no longer shall they stand. We are smitten by this riddle. As death we yearn shall cease. Thus we claim Christ's promises to be the fountain of our peace. All the righteous men that pass had befallen an able fate. Christ's last day word, the key of life, for it they must await. Life ever to last and escape from death is the warrant of his word. This is his claim from Father's throne. Only now can it be heard. The just will pass from death to life, no grave to mediate. This is the day that this light must blaze for all to contemplate. Only the pure who receive this call can announce this propitiation. They're the men who wave this cry, saints with consideration. Disciples indeed will advance his creed to all who will conceive Christ's glory and eternal peace when he blooms his mustard seed. And with that, I close the study.